Okay, today, so last week we finished dealing with a sad topic, so now we come to a happier topic for some, Hachnosas Kala and Simchas Chasam V'Kala, literally means escorting the Kala and giving joy, and the joy of a Chasam and Kala. So let's figure out all the various mitzvahs that are involved over here. Again, this is all following along these mitzvahs that you fulfill the mitzvah of loving your neighbor like yourself. You fulfill the mitzvah of emulating Hashem, because even when Adam and Chava were married, Hashem, so to speak, created the chasana environment for them. So we do the same thing. So what is the actual mitzvah that we're doing? And again, there is always a fine line between what the mitzvah is and what people do. So that's what we're trying to clarify. What is the mitzvah part and what is the non-mitzvah part? Not meaning to say the non-mitzvah part is not necessarily wrong, but it's just not a mitzvah either. So as people make choices, they have to decide, you know, on what is it worth spending money on. It's worth spending money on a mitzvah and not spending, you know, putting as priority spending money on something that's not a mitzvah. That's all I'm going to do here, and I'm not casting judgment on people. Okay, so hachnosas kala, escorting the kala. Escorting a kala is so important that it supersedes the mitzvah of Torah learning. That's how important that mitzvah is. Escorting the kala, we will see what that entails. That really entails really soup to nuts, which means if a kala doesn't have any money to get married, people have to make sure there is money for them to get married. That's a worthy tzedakah. So as a poor girl marries a poor boy, they can't say, well, I guess they can't get married till they get more money. No, the community has to take that responsibility to find a way for them to get married. Even though they may live in poverty, but they have to find a way to get married. That is all part of the mitzvah that takes, you even sell a sefer Torah if necessary in order for them to get married. Because what does it help for you to read from a Torah if two Jewish people are not living together as husband and wife, doing a much more important mitzvah than reading from a Torah? Now, that's an exaggerated case, but the Talmud is trying to underscore how important it is to have a man and a woman be married. Okay, and especially now it's even harder. Okay, the more people who are present at the wedding, the greater the honor of the chasan and Kala. Okay, we're going to have that typo all the time here. You see, because his name is in my spell check, right? Okay, and Kala. And the more we add to their joy and mutual endearment. So that means there should be a number of people at the wedding. However, we are not required to attend a wedding when we are certain that there are many people in attendance, whereby your presence will not be missed. So this becomes the age-old question. People say, well, I was invited to a wedding. Should I come? So again, there's should I come? Can I come? There's different questions you have to ask. Well, you can always go to a wedding, assuming that it's kosher and everything else is fine. The question is, many people are busy. And you could be invited, I don't know, in June, let's say. You could be invited to 10 weddings in June, let's say. Okay, so now the question isn't so much, can I go to the weddings? You may not have it's going to be difficult. Should I go to all the weddings? Do you hear the difference in the question? So that's, we're dealing with the should as opposed to the can. You can go to all the weddings you want, theoretically. But should I? So there is this fine balance between a wedding that is, the chas and kala will not be happy at versus a wedding that they will be happy at. So obviously, a wedding where nobody shows up, it's not going to be a very happy wedding. The chassan comes from out of town, let's say. Chassan lives in New York. He's getting married to a girl from Toronto, whatever. And it's in the middle of the summer. And therefore, all of his good friends are probably not going to come. And there'll be nobody to dance at the wedding. Well, now we're talking about a real mitzvah. Now people should come. Because if they don't come, he's going to feel very sad that he's kind of, you know, the other side. The girl's got her friends and everybody's there, and he doesn't have any friends to dance with. So then that becomes much more of a mitzvah to do that. However, if you're at a mitzvah, a wedding with, let's say, a tremendous amount of people are invited, and if you're not there, it really isn't going to make a difference to the chasen and kala and the family, then you're not required to go. And you say, well, but it's a mitzvah to go. No, there's enough people there. There may be other things that you want to do. For example, more so for men than for ladies, you know, a man has to learn Torah every day. So he learns Torah, let's say, every Tuesday night. That's his shiur, whatever. He learns for an hour. There's a wedding on a Tuesday night. That becomes an important question now. There's a mitzvah of learning Torah versus a mitzvah of going to a wedding. How do you decide? The answer is we have to prioritize. Okay, what kind of wedding were you invited to? Well, the chassan's from out of town. There's not going to be a lot of guys. He really needs people to be there. Well, then that would make it a priority to be at the wedding because that's more important than learning Torah. If you're invited to a wedding where there's a 1,000 people at the wedding and you're just one of the many friends that are there, then you're not required to go to the wedding. And matter of fact, you should be learning Torah instead. Okay, doesn't mean to say you can't compromise. And I find this fascinating that men don't understand this concept. You can do both. It really can happen. You can go to your shiur and go to a wedding. But what do you mean? The wedding's at 6 o'clock. That's okay. The wedding's at 6 o'clock. You can go to the wedding. But there's always, let's say a wedding that goes from 6 to 12, let us say, you can always get in your car, drive to where you have to learn, and come back, and you will not miss that much of the wedding. Right? And I don't know why people they think once you're at the wedding, you got to be there the whole time. The 6 hours at the wedding, the whole 6 hours is not all a mitzvah. A good part of it is, but not all of it is. And therefore, there's always the ability to do both, especially if, let's say, the wedding's at the bayit, let's say, where you don't even have to drive far. You know, you can just leave for an hour, and that's not the end of the world. And that way, you can do both. See, whenever you can do both, why not do both? So if you know you have a husband who has a shear, and there's a wedding that night, it would behoove you to say, dear, I think you can go for an hour. And, if let's say they're sitting next to you, say, it's okay, you can go for an hour and you can learn Torah. And that I think that's also important. Now, on the other hand, source 4, if someone has reason to believe the family would be hurt by your absence from their wedding, even if it's a large wedding, let's say you're a first cousin, you may be obliged to attend the wedding to fulfill your obligation to provide the chassan with what they call in the Torah, you have to give the poor person or the beneficiary of your mitzvah that which he is lacking. Sometimes even a rich person needs tzedakah because he's accustomed to more. So if this is part of his simcha of the wedding, that you should be there, even though it's a large wedding, but if you're not there, they will be sad, then one should make every effort to be there. So therefore, you need to understand the healthy balance over here of when it is a mitzvah and when it is not a mitzvah. Okay, is that I made that point clear? That's okay. Okay, simchas chasen v'kala. That's a separate mitzvah of giving them joy. It's a mitzvah to gladden the chasen and kala, both by dancing for them and by saying things that will make them happy. There's 2 points. Okay? So dancing, obviously, you dance, right? But the saying things that make them happy. So the primary way to gladden the chasen, and for that matter, it's the kala too, okay, is by singing the praises of his kala and saying how beautiful and charming she is, even if the compliments are a bit of an exaggeration, to reassure him that his choice was a good one. Often, a chasen kala are very anxious, especially in the religious world where they're not used to having physical contact with each other. It's a much scary or new adventure for them, and they want to be sure that things are okay. So therefore, they keep saying, oh, she's a wonderful girl, he's a wonderful chasen, you got such a great guy, this and that. The more you cannot overdo that. Even though everyone's saying it, you know, whatever you can say that's of that would make them feel better or good, you know, or confident, that's part of the mitzvah. It's not just the dancing.
So who would say that?
Anybody.
But when would women have a
chance? Whenever. It's not only at the wedding. got engaged, you can call him and say, wow, it's so good. You know, he's a wonderful boy. You should know. We had him at our house for Shabbos a couple months ago. He was so good. He helped clean up. He did this. He did that. All that is part of it.
And to the chassan, like how would someone
say to him? Listen, not everybody, not everybody can, but those that can should. If you're, you know, if you're invited to the wedding, generally you know somebody. Generally, right? So there's something good to be said to somebody, right? When you, let's say. Whatever. Let's say you're good friends with the Kala's parents. So, your family's good friends with the Kala's parents. So the guy can go to the husband, say, wow, you know, your in-laws, they're really great people. You know, something like that. Those kinds of things are always good to hear. You can never, nobody ever complains about hearing too many good things that will reassure them. So, there is that angst. I don't know what the right word is that a chas and kala have. You know, there's probably a better word than I'm using. Trepidation. They're happy, but they're also who knows? Especially now, everyone's so nervous. The crisis. People getting divorced. All this sort of. Maybe it's going to be me too. So the more people will reassure the chas and kala that their choice is good. Now, not everybody can do this. Not everybody. But there's certainly people who can. And that to the extent you should do that. Also, to make them just feel good. So gladdening the chassan and for them and the kala should be done in accordance with their level. Depends, you know, where their headspace is. So, for example, we can offer intellectually stimulating divrei Torah to a ben Torah. A guy who studies Torah, and you could say a little short, like 60-second dvar Torah about how wonderful marriage is and what great benefits accrue from marriage. That'll make him feel better. A simpler a real Talmud Chacham, you can even say something like with lumdus, with logic, whatever. A simpler person will derive pleasure from hearing divrei agada, which are lower level, not as difficult Torah concepts. Yet a simpler chassan will appreciate light conversation and amusing words. You know, making some jokes that are appropriate. But even this should carry a moral message for the couple. Which you're trying to give some words of encouragement to say how wonderful this is, what marriage is, and you know, and how fortunate you are that you're getting married and what opportunities marriage brings. And a clever person will find a way, either with a little bit of a little story or a little joke or whatever. You're trying to make the chassan feel happy. Now, if he has a lot of friends and they're all singing and he's into the singing, then he doesn't have to hear that. But we have an obligation. I'm sure I'm going to put it in somewhere. If you were getting married again, how would you have liked it a little better? You know what I mean? What could have it improved it on that? All right. Other ways to gladden the chassan kala can be fulfilled. This is more for men, this part. Being mesader kiddushin, arranging the wedding, saying a bracha under the chuppah or after benching, giving the chassan something to eat or drink, getting the chassan to laugh with a good joke, and so on. There's many ways you can fulfill this mitzvah. The presence of an important person at the wedding may also fulfill the mitzvah. They feel, oh, we're so honored that you took time out of your busy day to come to our wedding. The same can be said of someone who comes from afar and makes an unusual effort to attend the simcha. Those are all areas that people feel good about it. Now, musical instruments are an important element in bringing joy, and it's considered as much as a requirement as the suda. In other words, just as there's an obligation to make a celebratory meal, there's also an obligation that there should be music to an extent that will give them joy. Again, I'm not saying how much should be spent on all these things. I'm not going there. In Jerusalem, Ashkenazim limit musical accompaniment to one instrument. If you get married in Jerusalem, you're right where the temple is destroyed. It would totally be inappropriate to have a five-piece band at a wedding in Yerushalayim. So there the custom is to limit it much more to one instrument. Says the Talmud, the benefits of this, anyone who partakes of the wedding feast and does not gladden the groom, in other words, you go to a wedding and you're not dancing. That's not my thing. You go to the wedding, you don't say a word to the chassan, you eat your meal, okay, and then you leave. That's not good. Okay, so the Gemara used the following expression. We know when the Torah was given at Sinai, the word kol, voice or sound, was said five times. Five times, the voice of God, the voice of this. So, and it's interesting, when we say the last of the Sheva Brachas, kol sason v'kol simcha, kol chasan v'kol kala, kol mitzvah, also says kol five times. So there's some kind of connection between that. So anyone who does not gladden the groom, the Gemara uses the expression, degrades the five sounds with which Hashem blessed the Jews at Sinai. Which means to say your connection to Torah is weak. We see there's a very strong connection between a wedding and the events that happened at Sinai. God married the Jews at Sinai. There's a lot of customs of a wedding come out of the fact of what happened at Har Sinai. Many customs. And therefore, one of them, similar is obviously, is the five sounds. In other words, what the Gemara is really saying, if you don't go to a wedding, or you go to a wedding, but you don't gladden the chasan and kala, your Torah learning will suffer. That's really what's going to happen. Your Torah learning is going to suffer as a punishment. On the other hand, someone who does gladden the groom merits Torah, which was given with five sounds, and is considered as if he offered a korban todah, a thanksgiving offering, and rebuilt one of the ruins of Jerusalem. So that's the positive nature of causing joy to a chassan and kala. So that's a good motivation. So not only are you doing a mitzvah, but you're also rewarded with that as well. Okay, next. Now, let's say you're invited to a really fancy wedding and the food's really fancy. You might, if you're being overly religious, inappropriately, I really feel guilty having such a great meal over here. So, point 9 says, we're permitted to derive personal pleasure from the wedding. In fact, seeing the guests enjoying themselves definitely adds to the, fix that word, pleasure of the Baal Simcha. A Baal Simcha likes that his guests are happy. And he said, no, I'm not going to eat this. This is too gashmias. Well, even if it is, the Baal Simcha will have a lot of joy knowing that the guests are happy. So you're not, you know, don't think, well, you know, I'm supposed to do the mitzvah with purity of intent. How can I have that if I'm happy? No, you can really be happy. I mean, don't overdo it. Don't get drunk or things like that. But you can definitely be happy. However, the focus, again, when you're going to the wedding, the focus should be on bringing joy to the chassan and kala and their families. That is the reason you're walking into that wedding hall. That is goal number one. Now, not everybody can do it in such a large way, but in the group together, they're able to accomplish that. Okay? And that's, now I put finally on rule 10. The rule is to place oneself in the shoes of the chassan and kala, and do for them whatever we would like them to do for us, would we would be in their position. So that's a really important idea. I think, you know, people, it's a challenge when you're invited to a simcha, and there's a lot of, it's a very social environment, which is as it should be, but people tend to maybe get distracted of the goal of going to the wedding versus just the natural social environment. Am I trying to make the point over here? So again, there's nothing wrong with social. That is a place to social. It is a place. But you got to understand, there's the part that's the mitzvah and the part that's not the mitzvah. So like, let's try to figure out, when is the mitzvah really happening? It's really only happening when the chassan and kala and parents are there for you to do that. Right? What am I driving at? So I'm just saying, let's say, you know, when you come to weddings, that quite often there's a long break in the wedding from when you see the chassan and kala till you see them again. So for whatever reasons, I'm not judging why that's done or, you know, if it should be done. I'm just saying, could very well be from the chuppah till the next time you're going to say, it could be an hour and a half. So during that hour and a half, there's no mitzvah. I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying there's no mitzvah because there's nothing to mitzvah with. You have to remember the chassan and kala are, we'll call, you know, let's say this. Let's say on Sukkos, you take an esrog. The esrog is called the object of the mitzvah. And without the object of the mitzvah, you can't do the mitzvah. right? So when an esrog's there, you pick it up, and it's the object of the mitzvah. Okay, so now, what's the mitzvah here? Well, the object of the mitzvah is the chas and the kal. I'm not telling you to pick them up, necessarily, but the only time I can do the mitzvah is when the chas and the kal are there. So the question, or the challenge, or whatever it is, I understand both sides of the coin here. So let's say, you know, for you're at certain weddings where, you know, after the chuppah, you don't see the chas and kal for an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours, because whatever, they're taking pictures or whatever they're doing. And other weddings, you see them after 20 minutes. So the difference is, so that time in between is not a mitzvah time. So there doesn't mean you can't do what you're doing, but realize you're not doing a mitzvah. So therefore, if there's other opportunities for mitzvah at that time, you could be doing the mitzvah. So let me try to be pragmatic and practical here. So let's say people come to weddings. For some reason, they feel they have to bring cell phones at weddings. Okay, so the question is, when is it not appropriate to be engaged with one's cell phone at a wedding? Okay, certainly not during the chuppah. Now, she was mentioning last week about cell phones at a funeral, right? Michelle was mentioning about, she found it very distasteful, that she was correct. It's no less distasteful doing that at a chuppah. Just because nobody's dying doesn't mean that you should be scrolling. You know, you're at a wedding. You should be at the wedding. And if everyone's scrolling and talking and this and that, I mean, in some places it's like terrible. Like people, there's more noise in the audience than at the chuppah. I mean, that's not appropriate. That is the time to not be on your cell phones. Totally inappropriate. Okay, now, when there's an hour and a half between the chasen and kala, you're not going to see them, then it's very appropriate to have your cell phone, because I could get a lot of work done during that hour and a half that otherwise I'm, you know, not enough. You want to socialize, that's great, but not everybody wants to socialize. Okay, so you have your cell phone, and go talk on the cell phone for an hour and a half. As soon as the chasen and kala come in, shut off the cell phone, and then spend the time dancing with them. You follow what I'm driving at over here? Unfortunately, there's some people who don't know where to draw the lines. Or if you have that hour and a half that's there, that's a great time to, you find, for example, people daven Maariv. That's a good time to do that. It's not a bad thing if people would learn, men would learn Torah then during some of that time. I understand part of that time, because a lot of other times to socialize, it depends on the way, it depends on a lot of circumstances. I'm just trying to departmentalize the wedding, and for us to realize there's parts of the wedding that are mitzvah, parts of the wedding that are not mitzvah. To be focused more on the wedding, the mitzvah part of the wedding is where you have to be focused on the mitzvah, and the non-mitzvah part of the wedding is not the mitzvah, and then other behaviors are appropriate. Okay, any questions on that? Now, of course, it goes without saying that people who are making the simcha should be cognizant also a little bit of the guests' needs too. And to realize, you know, if you're making a wedding and people have to go to work the next day, you try to do it in a way that people can accomplish both. So that takes a lot more, there's a lot more to be spoken about, but I'm not going to go there. Okay, tznius issues. So there is something called a mitzvah tanz that is usually, it's called a mitzvah dance that is usually done in Hasidic circles, where after the guests leave, and only the family is there, or the really, really, really close friends, they do some type of a dance with the kala, where even men are involved with that. Now, even that's in a fairly tznius way. They're not holding on to the kala. You know, they take a rope, and the rope is quite a distance away. The kala just holds onto one end of the rope. And let's say the father, the grandfather, the uncle, they hold onto the other rope and they dance. Like the kala is like 10 feet away and there's the other rope and he dances with the rope. Okay, anyway, that's called, and that's big in Hasidic circles, which that's their minig and that's fine. And if they have that minig, you know, certainly, or if you marry into a family that has that minig, that's fine. But if you don't have that minig, really it's something that should not be done, because there is an important issue as point number two. There must be complete separation between men and women, especially during the dancing, especially when intoxicating beverages are consumed. Now, again, here's the other issue. No, with every mitzvah, the Yetzer Hara tries his best to taint the mitzvah. No matter what mitzvah we do, he tries to taint it. And at a wedding, there's, since it's such a big mitzvah, a wedding is an incredibly big mitzvah, what's happening over here, the Yetzer Hara has to work doubly hard to try to taint it as much as possible. And the easiest way to taint that is in, you know, forbidden socializing between men and women. Again, I'm not going to give a class on socializing. That's a whole different Musar type of halacha class that, unless you ask for it, I'm not going to give it. But you have to realize that there are some things that are, we'll say, patently osur, and they're totally forbidden. It's 100% an aveira. There's other things we'll call it borderline. Other things we'll call maybe a little bit more sensitive, and then the other things that are totally extreme. So what is totally forbidden? Let's talk about what's, nobody can argue unless they just don't want to follow halacha, right? So it's totally forbidden to have mixed dancing. It's like totally usher. That's like not a question, right? It's also usher. It's forbidden for men to watch women dance. A man is not supposed to watch a woman dance. Clearly. Should not do that. That is not good for that person's spirituality. So that's why you have a mechitza. Okay, fine. So you have to have a mechitza. That's done. Like the one at your wedding was a very nice mechitza. Okay. You can't see through the mechitza. I mean, just putting a couple potted plants is not a mechitza. I mean, yes, the men and women aren't dancing together, but it's not a mechitza. All right? It's not like in a shul. It's totally different. I mean, women... When you're dancing, your body is in what do you want to call it? A more revealed way. I don't know what a better word to use, right? When a woman's sitting at a table or eating is one thing. When she's dancing and jumping and this and that, you know, it's not something that should be beholden by men. You understand? I'm talking to people. I'm speaking to the converted here. But a lot of people don't get it. They don't get it. So the mechitza has to be a really good mechitza that you don't know. The men dancing would not even know there were women there on the other side and vice versa. Now, but to do that, you also have to remember that the seating plan has to be done in a way that everybody at every seat cannot see the women dancing. So even if you have a mechitza, so the only way you can, so you have to figure out how you can do that. Well, the only way you can really do that is if the men and the women sit separately. That's the easiest way to do it. The men are on one side eating, the women on another side eating. You got a mechitza down the middle, all the way from front to back. And therefore, the men will never see the women dancing. And that would be the optimal way. But that really borders on a second question. Do men and women have to eat separate seating? That's the next question. So the answer is, there's a debate amongst the rabbis. And that rate depends on where you are in the continuum. Many, many big rabbis say there's no problem with at an invited wedding where people have the difference between a wedding and, let's say, a social scene. An invited wedding where everyone has a designated seat would not be considered a tznius issue. So if you have five married couples at a table, that, according to many opinions, you can do that. There's many who are very strict and say you can't even do that. But I'm saying there's many who say you can do that. So there really would be nothing wrong with men and eating, husbands and wives eating together at a table. There's nothing wrong with that. The only problem is, then how do you negotiate the dancing? Because when the women and women, if you got, we got 10 tables here with men and women, 10 tables here. You got a mechitza here. The men dance here, the women dancing here. So what about all the men who have a seat over here and women dancing? Not everyone can dance the whole time. So then you have to, now you have to get a real trick to find a way to organize the room that the ladies dancing is really cordoned off. You follow? Instead of just one mechitza down the middle, you have to now make like a three-sided mechitza where the women are now like in a corner. And now there's at least two mechitzas that don't allow them to be seen at all. That's where it becomes technically challenging. But you follow what I'm saying. And I've been at weddings where they had people sitting, men and women were sitting together. And then that's not appropriate. I won't officiate at such a wedding. I mean, that's just my way. But others will. But and you have another problem. I've been at weddings where, okay, even if the men and women are separate, but they're serving the dessert in the ladies' section. I was once at a wedding. I said, why are they doing that? Serving at them. So it was the buffet dessert, right? Buffet dessert. Let's be done during the dancing. And all the desserts were in the ladies' section, like on the wall beyond. So how am I going to get there without seeing the ladies dancing? So that's also not a good idea. So therefore, those are the tznius issues that we are talking about. But again, you can definitely, if let's say you're not dealing with, let's say it's a sheva brachas and there's no dancing, then for sure you could have men and women sitting next to each other. Again, it's again from a tznius issue, it would not be advisable to have a table full of single men and single women from a tznius aspect. Doesn't mean to say shadchanim can't be busy working to try to introduce boys to girls at a wedding. There's nothing wrong with that because it's for more of a constructive purpose. Okay. Point four. Families should refrain from spending exorbitant amounts of money in order to make elaborate, expensive weddings beyond what is necessary. Everyone can define what they feel is necessary. I'm not going to tell you what that definition is. Okay, moving on. Questions? Comments? No? Providing the couple with their needs. That's the next point. A father must exert himself personally and financially to marry off his children. I'm using a quote off of the Gemara now. He should sell everything that he owns so as to marry off his daughter to a Talmud Chacham, if that's possible and that's practical. But it's definitely a burden, I don't know, burden, a responsibility upon a father to make sure his children get married off. If the wife would like to help him with the burden, she can. But it really is the father's responsibility. Let's say you don't have enough money for this. Well, then I guess you're going to have to mortgage things. I know many rabbis who told me, I know one rabbi in particular who told me as he was older, he said, every wedding, it was a rabbi, so he wasn't making a lot of money. He says, every wedding we had to borrow for the weddings. And he had like 6-7 kids. And he said, it took me years from after the last kid was married, it took me many years till we finally paid off for the weddings. So that's just an example of how you have to exert yourself for that. And even if, and if you're really not that wealthy, you can even, the father has to collect tzedakah in order to marry off his children. You know, what do you do if you don't have that much money? You know, so you gotta go around and asking for money. And that's point four. The community is obligated to provide whatever is necessary for a poor chas and kala, yet should be discreet when doing it. Okay, a poor person who is provided for through tzedakah must be given the needs that he is lacking, which would include food, clothing, household utensils, and living quarters. Okay, so that's the point. So if you see it as a young couple, not all couples have the money to get married. That's not a reason for them not to get married. Okay, we're not talking that a boy, you know, who still has to go learn a trade and wants to get married at 16. No, we're not obliged to provide them with what they need, you know, at least to a reasonable age. Although the halacha says a man should get married. Gemara says a man should get married at 18. Okay, even beyond that, posts can say, okay, 21, 22. After 22 already, this, that, in the halacha, that guy's getting old. Okay? Okay, maybe you could stretch it another year or two, but it gets to a point you can't, a man is not meant to live till he's 30 before getting married. That's clear. Because there's not a lot of time on the clock. So, and that's a mitzvah. And we don't push off the mitzvah for that. Again, I'm not getting into the philosophical issues. Does a guy have to be ready to make a parnasa and all those things? And he has, you know, there is this idea that, well, only until he has a job, until he has enough money to provide for his wife, all those things. You know, that was good in the old days when you were a farmer or you had those kinds of things where it was possible and you didn't have to compromise on the age of getting married. But if a guy says, I want to be a doctor, and by the time I'm going to make my first dollar, I'm going to be 32 years old and then get married, that would not be in accordance to halacha. Because there's no mitzvah to be a doctor, there's no mitzvah to make that much money, and there is a mitzvah to get married as soon as he can get married, which he is delaying unnecessarily. So therefore, in a society like today, it's often going to be that the kids are going to get married before the husband can provide for the wife. That's just the way life is. And therefore, people have a responsibility to take care of them and they can still get married. And that really should be a communal undertaking. Okay, just as much as we understand that the community has to take responsibility to pay for tuition for kids who can't afford to pay tuition, the community has to have a responsibility to pay for children to get married who can't afford to get married. Okay, that needs a lot of vetting, and it could be subject to abuse that you don't want to be subject to, just like tuition subsidies we know can be subject to abuse. People say, oh, we need money, and they get subsidies, and they're going on expensive vacations. So everything can be subject to abuse. But in theory, we would never think of children not getting a Jewish education because they couldn't afford it. The community has a responsibility to pay money for that. That is a bona fide tzedakah. So it's a boy who's 24, let's say, and a girl who's 22, and they don't yet have the wherewithal to support themselves, so they shouldn't get married? So I don't know why people don't talk more about that. But that's a serious issue. That's all part of Achnasas Kala. That's all part of it. People aren't getting married because they don't have the money for it? That should not be. And thank God, God has given enough wealthy Jews in every city in the world who can do this. So that's just my comment. All right? And that's what I said. You have to even sell a Sefer Torah to make this happen. So the communities have money to build the most magnificent shuls and having 5, 7, 10 Sefer Torah that they don't need. People are very much, oh, I want to give a Sefer Torah to send that. That costs $50,000. Why don't you give $50,000 to this couple that would get married and already have two kids with your $50,000? It's much more important than a Sefer Torah. So if you think of a new mitzvah project, this might be an idea. Anyway, that concludes the discussion of this area. Now, so I really, that's what I prepared. Then I debated, well, should I talk about Sheva Brachas? So I figured I would. So I hope this is going to be going in the right direction. We'll start it. If you say, Rabbi, I'm really not interested in that, then I'll just stop and we'll do something else next week. If you find it interesting, we can continue it. Okay, so that makes sense. It's a related topic. Okay, Sheva Brachas. So first, let's understand our terms. People often misunderstand the term. So the phrase Sheva Brachas, literally, Sheva means seven, all right? Brachas means blessings, refers to a set of blessings, usually seven in total, recited in conjunction with the marriage ceremony and at a meal eaten in honor of the new couple during the first week of their marriage. Colloquially, this term is used to refer to the meal at which these brachas will be recited, although that's not really a true statement. I'm making a Sheva Brachas. That is technically an inaccurate linguistic statement. Because what it really means is I'm making a seven blessings. So that's what we're saying. But colloquially, so you're still not wrong in saying it, just to know what you're saying. You're making a meal at which seven blessings will be recited. So that's just to know this. The Sheva Brachas really is just the seven blessings that you make under the chuppah or following a meal. That's what Sheva Brachas are. Sheva Brachas are said only under a chuppah or at a celebratory meal during the week that the chasan and kala are celebrating. So that's at least the term. Technically, only six of these blessings are actually unique to the marriage celebration, as the seventh bracha is the hagafen made on a cup of wine. So that was, okay, the text can be found in other siddurim, fine. Okay, general laws. Okay, so since it's Sheva Brachas is under the chuppah and is also not under the chuppah, so I threw in a little bit of under the chuppah because it kind of goes together with what's after it. So just we'll go through that part a little quicker. The general laws. The couple traditionally honors attendees with appointing them to recite the Sheva Brachas. Because these blessings are meant especially for the bride and groom, it's better that the groom himself not recite them, and for the person reciting the blessings to face the couple. Or if nobody else present is able to say the brachas, the groom may do so. Here's an interesting example. Let's say you're making Sheva Brachas, and a lot of the people there are secular, or they're not good at reading. I know this, now you can't relate to this, but some guys like get real anxiety when they go to Sheva Brachas. You should just know that. Why? Because not everybody can read so well. And they certainly aren't used to reading Sheva Brachas. And if you give the guy to read it, and you may not, you know, especially a Baal Tshuva who may look very religious on the outside with a hat and everything, but really has never overcome the challenge of reading properly, it could be quite an embarrassing thing to just hand him a sitter with a bench and say the bracha. So therefore, That's something in general that should be kept in mind. I've seen, unfortunately, many embarrassing situations that could have been avoided had people been more careful. They just, you know, asked someone to do it or whatever, and they gave them the wrong bracha. If you call a rabbi, you never have to worry. You know, the rabbi just comes and he does it, you know. That's why I usually give it to rabbis. Or if they said, rabbi, I'm going to give you the third bracha. Oh, we changed. We're going to give you the sixth bracha. Big deal. It just doesn't make a difference. If you ask a layperson, you know, I was at a wedding where a layperson was told they're getting this blessing. By mistake, they prepared a different blessing. They called him up, and all of a sudden, he found it was a different blessing. He could not say the blessing and had to sheepishly step down and let somebody else come. It was incredibly embarrassing, and it could have been very much avoided had people not made some foolish mistakes. That's where it's important to consult with your local Mossad or Kedushin before you give out honor, so he can make sure those embarrassing situations don't happen. But anyway, so what's the point over here? The point is, the chassan, really, technically, why couldn't the chassan say the Sheva Brachas? Well, the answer is kind of funny, to bless himself. Because most of the blessings are directed in honor of and for the chassan and kala, so it's kind of not appropriate for him to say it. But what happens if you're at a Sheva Brachas and nobody really can read so well, and only the chassan can really read well, then the chassan could say the Sheva Brachas. That's the point I'm making over here. Alright? Many believe that the same person must receive. Now, there's an interesting difference. If you see, sometimes they do a little different. Some hold, very early poskim say, that only one person should say all the Sheva Brachas. That really was the original way it was done. Wimber just says all seven. All Sheva Brachas. Just like you have, for example, a chazan does the repetition shon esrei, he does all the brachas. So the guy who's running the show should make all the brachas. That really was the earlier tradition. But the near universal practice is to permit dividing the brachas amongst various people, especially because there are usually several people who the family wants to honor. In other words, the family will feel more honored if they can have five rabbis make brachas, as opposed to one rabbi, or uncles and cousins and grandparents, or whoever. They'd rather, you know, you have two grandparents and two uncles, who you want to make a fight with. So, and I'm sure that was the reason why the original custom was altered. Okay? Used to be, I'm imagining, in the old days, the rabbi was in the Seder Kedushin, he made all the brachas, and that was all fine. Somehow along the way, you know, little cracks got in, and somehow they said, okay, how about, you know, my grandfather, he's a shtickle rabbi, he wants to, well, okay, we'll give him. So you can understand how this kind of evolved. And now, especially with, you know, larger families, and thank God, you know, people are living longer, there's more people to honor, so okay. So I guess it ends up, you have to give more honor and break things up. But interestingly enough, all those reciting the brachos should still make sure to listen and say amen to all the other brachos. So now you're in and out, you should listen to all of them. The order of the brachos is very interesting. What if this happens? Again, I don't know if you need to. Well, we had a Sheva brachos at your house, you may need to know this. See, a lot of these things you say, I don't need those, the rabbi needs those. But some of these overlap into Sheva brachos in the house, and there's no rabbi in the house reading a Sheva brachos. What do you do then? So far, I never got called in the middle of a Sheva Brachas to answer a Shiloh. It's interesting. I'm surprised it hasn't happened. But anyway, so that's why I'm learning these laws. So the order of the Brachas is not essential. So I've been at weddings, and again, the Mossad or Kedushin has to know a little bit what's going on over here. You go to the wedding, and he's honored with the third Bracha. So what happens is the guy read the fourth Bracha. He's supposed to read the third Bracha. He read the fourth Bracha. Now what do you do? So the answer is, the order is not to be particular about. So even if the wrong bracha was said, so just on the spot, you make a quick switch. So if he's called and say bracha 3, and he gets up and says bracha 4, okay, so guess what? He said bracha 4, fine. So the next guy you call for bracha 4, you give him bracha 3. Now you can understand why you'd rather have people who are more proficient in reading brachas. Right? Because if I give two lay people, one bracha 3, one bracha 4, and the guy with bracha 3 mistakenly prepared bracha 4 and did bracha 4. Okay, fine. Now I got to call a guy for bracha 4 who's prepared bracha 3. And, oh, I don't know that one. Okay, but that's a lot. So now, going back to that story, I don't know, this story really bothered me. That's why I'm telling it to you. So what happened in this story is a good friend of one of the parties was asked to give have a bracha. And he was a lay person, a Baal Tshuva, who really wasn't that good, but they told him in advance what the bracha, and he really practiced it, so he would do it right. Then he gets called up there, and you see, I wasn't the Masadar Kedushin at that wedding. I'm not complaining about the other people, but I was not happy with the way the person was Masadar things there. I just wasn't happy. It was, you know, you'd be surprised. It makes a difference who your Masadar Kedushin is. And so the guy comes up, and I'm sitting back there, and I just see nothing's happening. He's not made bracha, and he sheepishly walked away. Okay? Then I found out that he had prepared the wrong bracha. Now, a smart Masadar Kedushin would have let him make the bracha. And just the next guy will do the other bracha. And that's all. So that, you know, instead of the guy being embarrassed, you know, you'd switch the order and do that. So that's what I'm saying. These are subtle things, but you don't realize. And then when you're up there, oh, what am I going to do? You know, so you have to know exactly what to be done. I don't know if you've experienced things like that. Maybe you just don't realize what's going on. You say, oh, what's that pause going on over there, right? So, you know, that's what the pause. So let's say you're at your house, though. You're giving out Sheva Brachas. And the guy reads the wrong Sheva Brachas. So now you at least know that, okay, then just get them done. They don't have to be done in the right order. Okay. Minyan. Yeah?
Is there something to the idea that the people who are honored with Sheva Brachas at the meal at the meals following, like the week following the wedding, should somehow be people who didn't attend?
That we're going to come to that.
Okay.
We're going to come to that. Okay. Oh, minyan. One needs a minyan to the Sheva Brachas, whether under the chuppah or during the week after. We'll talk about more. The minyan does not have to be standing under the actual chuppah, but must be able to hear the brachas directly and not through a microphone. Also an interesting point. If they can only hear through a microphone, then you're not close enough. There's many rabbis who prefer not to use a microphone. If only the final bracha of Asher Bara will be recited, the seventh bracha is Asher Bara. We'll see below. We'll talk about this. Only three men need to have joined the meal and be present. Berachas Amon. You'll understand this better when we get a little further on. If the Sheva Brachas begun while a minyan was present, but then some of the people left before all the brachas were recited, they may still continue to recite the remaining brachas. So generally, you need 10 people for Sheva Brachas. Under a chuppah, it's usually not a problem. Although it is interesting. Let's say a person wants to make a very quiet wedding. Let's say second wedding, second marriage, with it, and there was issues, and they don't want to, you know, no one to do it publicly. Still got to have 10 people. For a bris, you don't have to have 10 people. But for a wedding, you got to have 10 people. Unless it's really extreme, like under Russian tyranny. But generally, you have to have 10 people. And the brachas need 10 people. So when you're dealing with Sheva brachas, whether under the chuppah or in your home, you still need 10 people. We're just saying, though, if you started with 10, and during the Sheva brachas, and then somebody left, you can still finish the Sheva brachas. Now, that's point five. It's the point. If there's no minyan at the chuppah, some say the couple should delay the marriage until they're able to find one, while others believe that it's better to get married as planned than make the brachas. Okay, fine. Who's included in the 10 people? The groom is included in the minyan, as are any of his relatives, the Masada Kedushin and the Eidei Kedushin. Any man who's involved can be one of the 10 people. Women do not count towards the minyan for Sheva Brachas. So when you're making Sheva Brachas at home, and you want to say all the Sheva Brachos, you have to have 10 men. Okay? A minor does not count for the minyan of Sheva Brachos. Okay, let me make this point clear. I don't want to miss a thing. You may make a Sheva Brachos without 10 people being there. Remember, there's making the Sheva Brachos, meaning the meal, versus saying the Sheva Brachos. Those are two separate things. You want to host a Sheva Brachos for Chasan and Kala? Amazing. But guess what? You only can come up with 6 men and 6 women. Is it wrong to do that? I'm going to try and find the right word. Is it inappropriate? Is it okay? So let's understand. It's okay to do that. It's okay to have a wedding meal, a post-wedding meal, you know, a Sheva Brachas meal on a Wednesday, inviting 5 couples. There's no problem with it. And if the Chasan Kala are really happy to have these 5 couples there, and they will be, remember, what's the point of all this? You're trying to gladden the hearts of the Chasan and Kala for one full week. What will gladden their hearts? Well, if they would have five couples at this Sheva Brachas where they're good friends and really have a good time and they're happy with that, that's amazing. The only thing is, and there's nothing wrong with that, and they have a meal and they're happy and singing and that's good. The only thing is, we can't say all the seven blessings afterwards. If you want to say the seven blessings afterwards, you have to have 10 males there in the room for the seven blessings to be made. So it doesn't mean to say you can't make a Sheva Brachas if you don't plan on having 10 men there. Now, obviously, it would be encouraged because now you can make the blessings. And that's an important thing, to make the blessings. That's not a small thing. So there's all kinds of ways that we can come up with the 10. But it doesn't mean that it's the end of the world if you don't have 10 people. It's not, oh, the whole Sheva Brachas was a failure. We didn't have 10 men. We couldn't say all the blessings. It's not a failure. You don't have to worry about it. And we'll see. There's still one or two blessings you can still make, even without 10 men. Okay? I hope that I'm making this point clear. I think it will get confused between the term, the meal of the Sheva Brachas, and the seven blessings that are made. One does not depend on the other. Okay. Cup of wine. Where am I getting to the other point? I know it's an important point, and I didn't want to forget it. Yeah. All right. You know what? Let me skip for a minute. I just want to make sure I got the right thing. All right, okay, fine. I'm not going to skip. I'm sorry. So, cup of wine. Even under the chuppah, where the brachas are not recited with birchas hamazon, the sheva brachas should be recited over a cup of wine. If wine is not available, another alcoholic beverage should be used. Okay. Regarding the cup under the chuppah, those reciting the brachas do not need to drink from the cup, but the bride and groom should at least taste from it. They need not drink a cheekful. As opposed to, let's say, Kiddush Friday night, when you're drinking wine, the person drinking the wine from the Kiddush cup has to drink a cheekful. Chas and Kala do not have to drink a cheekful. When making Shav brachas after a meal, the Ramah writes that two cups of wine should be used, one for the benching and the other for the six brachas made for the couple. However, everyone agrees with this ruling, and Shulchan Aruch writes that the custom is to use one cup. This may be relied upon if only one cup is available. So for Sephardim, they would use one cup. Ashkenazim used two cups. In case, for some reason, you wouldn't have two cups at a Sheva Brachas, you could use one cup. But anyway, we use two cups. Okay, under the chuppah and after the meal. Okay, I'm going to do this quickly. After eating the ksuba, all seven brachas are recited under the chuppah, regardless of the status of the bride and the groom, as long as 10 Jewish men are present. The custom has developed in almost all Jewish communities for these brachas to be recited while the bride and groom are under the chuppah, but before entering the yichud room. If the brachas were not recited beforehand, they can still be recited several days later. If for whatever reason you couldn't say sheva brachas under the chuppah, you could still say them afterwards. A new cup of wine should be used and not the one already used for Birchas Erisin. In other words, when the rabbi makes the blessings before the wedding, the giving of the ring, that's one cup of wine. A new cup of wine is used for the Sheva Brachas. If you only have one Kiddush cup, then you rinse it out. That could happen sometimes you didn't bring a Kiddush cup. But again, at a wedding hall, you're probably going to leave even a glass is fine. Some posts call that everyone in the audience must stand for the Sheva Brachas recited under the chuppah. Not all. A lot of people stand when Chas and Kala get up. But there's a lot of say you should stand for the Sheva Brachas. Okay. The order of Sheva Brachas under the chuppah. Now, here's another important thing. People make a mistake, and you think the order is the same. And this is where these big mistakes come, and the person prepares the wrong bracha. Happens all the time. There's a different order. When you say Sheva Brachas under the chuppah, the blessing on the wine is first. When you're saying a Sheva Brachas during a meal, the blessing on the wine is last. So when you're giving somebody the third Sheva Brachas, you got to be clear what you mean by the third Sheva Bracha. Well, in the art scroll page here, it's the third one. Yeah, but in the art scroll page there, it's the fourth. You follow. If you look in a Siddur, by the wedding part, the wine is the first and everything follows. At the meal part, in the bencher part of the art scroll Siddur, the wine is the seventh Bracha. So that changes all the other Brachas. So you're the very person who's very organized. You want everyone to know exactly what they're doing. So you tell them that, okay, Uncle Joe, you're getting the fourth Sheva Brachas. Don't write that. Say the four Sheva Brachas, starting with the words sos tasis, or whatever. Whatever that word is. And that's why that problem happened that I talked to you about. So therefore, you should know, it doesn't start, it flips. And therefore, the brachas are different as well. So that's an important little nuance that many people don't get. Okay, initially, a person who partakes at the wedding feast is required to remain until the Sheva Brachas have been said. That's a very interesting halacha. You go to a wedding, and you're part of the group of 300 people at this wedding, and you're eating the meal, you really are obliged to stay until the end of the Sheva Brachas. That's the halacha. Whoa, but the Sheva Brachas ain't going to be made till 11:30 at night. I got to be at work. I mean, I was nice enough to be there at 6 o'clock, and I'm happy to be with them, but I can't stay till 11:30. That's a problem. You just can't think, oh, I can just bench them out. It's not so simple. It's a big, big machlokas in the poskim, what we do over here. So therefore, I'm just giving you the final resolution here. However, as many people cannot stay until the very end of the wedding, there's a simple solution. At the beginning of the meal, one should have specific intent before you're making the motzi that he does not want to be part of the wedding meal. When you initially exclude yourself from it, by having in mind that he does not want to be included in everyone else's meal, but is rather eating alone, he will not be required to hear the Sheva Brachas or recite the Zimun, that's part of it. Through this stipulation, he has removed himself from the larger wedding meal and may leave whenever he wishes. Now, if you're a man, those leaving early can bench with a Zimun of a smaller quorum. In other words, if the fellow had in mind before he started the meal that I'm going to leave early, he can bench and he can ask two people at his table to answer for him, and he can fulfill his little zimun, or if he has 10, and then he can leave and other people can stay. On the other hand, there's another way out. Don't eat bread. If a guest is not required to recite Berachas HaMazon, such as he only ate fruit and drinks, he may leave without hearing Sheva Brachas. So that's another option on the table. And a lot of people are weight conscious. They don't want to eat bread, whatever. It's a mitzvah, whatever. But anyway, so those are the two ways you can avoid that sticky issue. Okay, time for another section, or you want to stop? Another 2 minutes, or you want to stop? Okay, at this time I could already do another. Okay, the week after marriage, where either bride or groom have never been married before, meals can be made in their honor for the 7 days after the wedding, with the day of their wedding counting as the first day. Although a meal can be made with Sheva Brachas for all 7 days, so important, there is no obligation to do so each day. Many people are not aware of that. They feel have to have at least, because they feel Sheva Brachas means 7 days of Sheva Brachas. No, it means during these 7 days, if the Chasan and Kala are together in a celebratory meal, then, and there's 10 men, then there's 7 brachas made. There's no obligation to have a Sheva Brachas meal every night of the week. Not an obligation, especially the Chasakala don't want it. Okay, and a lot of people have this tremendous pressure. Not everybody is so popular to have so many friends that are offering to make Sheva Brachas. And they already spent a lot of money on the wedding, and it's a real financial hardship and also a time hardship. People got to go to work. It's not so simple. So therefore, if the chasan and kala are fine, I know when I got married, one night we didn't have Sheva Brachas. It was no big deal. There's no number of Sheva Brachas you have to make either. It's not like people make a mistake. We have to have 7 meals for Sheva Brachas. The wedding is 1. We got to make 6 more. That's totally erroneous. The only thing is, during the 7-day period where the Chas and Kala have to be gladdened, we gladden it by making parties for them. Okay, you make parties as required, as necessary, and as they're available. So, yeah, if they want every night of the week, that's fine. You do it every night of the week. If they don't, not. Shabbos, you have 3 opportunities. You have Friday night, you have Shabbos day, you have Shalosh Shudos. Yeah, you could make Sheva Brachas at each one of those meals. There is no rule of any hard, fast numbers to do. There's many factors involved. You have family. Not everybody could go to the wedding. Let's say you got to invite people. That could be one obligation. You have an out of town. There are 2 different, couple different cities. You can only be in this city for 3 days and this city for 3 days. You know, or they're all in town. Maybe it's a small family. Maybe it's a really small family. You don't have a lot of friends. Now they got to scrape and scratch to find it. You'd speak to the chasan. What is it that they want? If they don't want any Sheva Brachas afterwards, you don't make any Sheva Brachas. Okay, it's customary to have it. It's usually an enjoyable thing. It would give them joy. But there's no hard and fast number. You want to have a day without Shevbrachas? That's totally fine. You want to have two on that day? You want to have lunch Wednesday with a bunch of friends? And Wednesday night, you can have 10 Shevbrachas in one day if that's what you want to do. But that the only rule is you have to have 10 meals to recite the Shevbrachas. Okay, this is the last 2 points. These meals have a status of Sudas Mitzvah. It's therefore preferable to have meat and wine, preferable. But Shevbrachas are still recited if there's no meat or wine. The Shevbrachas are only recited at a meal which bread is eaten and Birchas HaMazon is recited. Okay, so you want to continue this next week?
Yeah,
it's okay? All right, we'll talk about Panim Chadoshes, new faces, mixing the cups, second marriages, other practices during the week of Shevbrachas.
Thanks,
Rabbi. Okay, any requests?